Good evening, everyone. This is Dr. Nalini Chilko. Welcome to our live Ground Rounds call for Foundations of Integrative Oncology. This call will last approximately 1 hour. We'll start with a clinical pearl and then move into questions that have been submitted by all of you. There'll be plenty of time to interact. I pause between sections, and at that time, you can press *7, or if you're on a web call, you can unmute yourself on the screen and ask a question. And I ask you to just keep yourself muted so there's not background noise from wherever you are while we are all talking. So that's *7 to unmute yourself. This evening, we didn't have a case study that was really fully ready. So instead, I'm going to take a deeper dive in the handful of questions that were asked, and I'm also going to do a clinical pearl tonight on circulating tumor cells. So I'm going to start there, looking at liquid biopsies. This is something that Dr. Stacy DeAndre asked about, so I'm going to give an overview. And then there were some questions about managing hypercoagulation in patients. There was another question about the safety of resveratrol and HER2-new. And there was also a question about HPV vaccines. And then I'm going to talk also at the end of this call about the perceived stress questionnaire that we might want to use with our patients as is appropriate. So I will dive right in to our circulating tumor cells. For those of you that did not look at your emails before the call, if you go to your email inbox, there will be an email from us, and there's a link to the PDF of the slides I'm about to use for this talk, and then also they're all my notes for this call as well, because it's more of a teaching call, and I thought it would enhance your learning to have the notes in front of you. So if you have access to your email, you'll find those documents, and of course they do get uploaded after the call as well, along with the recording. And I just want to say, I always love looking at who's here. We have people from all over the country and also Canada on this call. So I always love that. All right, so this is an introduction to liquid biopsies, and I want to just give you a brief understanding of what they are, at the existing technology today that we have, what I'm using, and when and why you would want to use them, and what kind of information you can get out of a biopsy, a liquid biopsy of circulating tumor cells and cell-free tumor DNA. So just start, you know, imagine a tumor cell that's made of a heterogeneous mass of other cells. And so cells can shed off of that tumor mass. And those will be circulating tumor cells as well as stem cells. And certain cells are adapted to be able to travel in the bloodstream. Remember, most cells that shouldn't be in the bloodstream are attacked by the immune system, and certain cells are adapted to be able to survive the immune system, travel through the bloodstream and arrive at a new location. And of course, that's what metastatic progression is. So these cells have to go through a transformation called the epithelial to mesenchymal transformation. And so that transformation is something we can measure now in these liquid biopsies, and I'll talk about that momentarily. There are also stem cells that are less differentiated cells that can shed off the tumor cell, the tumor mass. Remember that tumors are made up of a really heterogeneous population of cells, and that's why also cancer is challenging. And the more we can understand present tense what we're dealing with, the more targeted and individualized our treatment plans can be, and therefore, hopefully, the better outcomes. So once these circulating tumor cells are in the bloodstream, they can be captured by some of the newer technologies. There aren't very many of them, And so if you do find them, it's significant because the presence of them is not ubiquitous. And so if there are some, we know that there are some others. And so I started using circulating tumor cells with a company called Cell Search maybe 10 years ago, and that was the old technology. And I'm going to show you the newer technology that we have now that's really so much more reliable and much better. And now I'm really actively using this in patients whose cancers are approved for this. And so we'll go through that too. But it's important to know what kind of tumors shed these cells. So it's primarily your epithelial carcinomas. And so not every kind of cancer will produce these types of cells, but there's quite a lot of cancers that do. And there has to be sufficient research showing that they're measurable and that they're valid. The lab that I use is BioCept, BioCept. And they have a pretty educational website. They have a lot of case studies on it and a lot of reference articles and some good slides. And so that's a good resource for you if you're wanting to learn a lot more. And I intend to teach more on this, but I think having an overview and an understanding is a really good place to start in a short talk like this. So what we're really testing are circulating epithelial tumor cells. So just to clarify that. And there's a lot of different hypotheses of where these origins are, but what is known is that these are shedding from the tumor itself. And so you can find three different things in the blood with these new technologies. You can find circulating tumor cells, you can find circulating stem cells, cancer stem cells, and you can find cell-free tumor DNA. And so what's different about the technology now is it's more accurate. And now we can actually look at the cells and use these captured cells to do studies that we only could do on tissue recovered by surgery or biopsy. So it's pretty amazing. And I'm going to give you a few examples of high value of using them. So we want to understand that there is the metastatic potential has unfolded once you find the circulating tumor cells. And that gives us an opportunity for really early intervention when we can identify the micrometastasis. Or think about also when there's no mass. There, for example, with ovarian cancer, sometimes you'll see the tumor marker CA125 rise and there's just diffuse cells. There's no mass. And so there's nothing to biopsy. So having these cells that we can collect from the blood, we can then analyze these cells to try to understand what kind of therapy we ought to be choosing. And that's really helpful. Or if you had a patient who didn't have metastatic disease and then you found circulating tumor cells, you would know that she was in early metastasis if there was also no mass. She had not yet had a recurrence. So we'll go over all of that. But this really allows us to identify more early when physiology is changing, to intervene earlier, to understand when people are having early recurrences, but also you can monitor whether or not a treatment is working. So a lot of times the oncologist will do maybe 4 cycles of chemotherapy and then do a scan to see if the tumor is shrank. And so we could actually find out in a month whether or not the treatment was working. And we can also find out, for example, at the end of hormonal therapy, if there are still resistant cells. And so this is really valuable, and it's not invasive. It's a blood draw. So these are the main reasons to do these, to get these valuable insights on tumor activity, behavior, relapses, and to distinguish between effective and less effective therapies in patients. And you can do these every 3 to 6 months, and Medicare and most insurance companies actually pay for it through this lab. When you submit, when you place an order, a requisition, the lab requires you to prove that the patient has a definite cancer diagnosis because they are not approved to try to find cancer. So if the patient doesn't have a pathology report or a definite a tumor marker or a definite radiology study such that their diagnosis is certain, they're not allowed to perform this test. So you need to get permission from the patient to share records with the lab because of HIPAA privacy laws, and then you need to have a copy of something. Now you should just send like the first page or two of a pathology report, and that's sufficient for their documentation needs. And so that is something to consider when you fill out a requisition form for the lab. All right, so let's go on then and look at what's the difference between what was available 10 years ago and what was available now. So now we, number one, have better ways of capturing and finding these cells, so it's less common to have a false negative. And that was a problem with the old technology, is you get a zero result, but that might have been wrong many times. So now it's the technology to actually capture and find these cells and this circulating DNA is much, much better. The cost has also gone down, and the ability to correlate what is found in the cells with previous tissue biopsies or current biopsies is getting much, much better. So the correlations are much, much better. And now we have the opportunity to identify circulating tumor cells that are keratin positive and keratin negative. And I'll explain that to you more momentarily. And that just refines our ability to understand what's going on physiologically. And now what's really fantastic is this little sample of cells can be used to actually do biomarker status. You can look for estrogen receptors, progesterone receptors, HER2 receptors, androgen receptors. And so you can also look at some gene expression as well. So again, it's almost like having tissue, which is really amazing. The lab that I use, the BioCEP, there are other labs. It's just this is the lab I use and have faith and confidence in. There are many that I haven't tried. This lab has the ability to show you cells that are displaying different phenotypes. So one of those is cytokeratin positive, so it's this little protein sticking out from the cell. And then the cells that lose that are called cytokeratin negative. And those cells are much more readily able to metastasize. So Dan Rubin, who is very experienced working with his lab and with this technology and following patients with these, calls the cytokeratin negative cells that they're intending to be metastatic. So they haven't yet arrived and planted themselves and made a new location, but they're on their way there. They have the potential to do that. So that's what you learn when you read on the report. If there are not any cytokeratin negative cells, then you don't have as much metastatic potential, basically. What happens to these cells is some of the cells will lose their keratin, and they'll go through a transformation from being an epithelial phenotype to being kind of a hybrid epithelial metastatic mesenchymal, a less differentiated type of cell that can travel to a new location. And then when it gets to the new location, it will resume its epithelial phenotype and be able to seed a new tumor in a new site. So there's this process that goes on with these cells. And not all cells in a tumor mass are specialized to do this. So some cancers metastasize more readily. And remember that cancers typically metastasize to locations where there's more blood flow, because that's how these cells get delivered. So that would be the very vascular areas of the liver, the lungs, the brain, the bone marrow. Those are the places where you get the most metastasis, because that is where there is the most delivery of these cells. All right, so this is really the leading edge of doing personalized cancer diagnostics and tracking also treatment impact. So when you can't get tissue, you want to see if this is a viable option. Or if you don't want to do an invasive procedure on a patient, you'd love to have biopsy tissue, then this is a viable option. When you have a patient who doesn't have any location where it would be safe to do a biopsy on them, that's often the case. Or you have a patient who's so immunosuppressed, you don't want to put them at risk by doing a biopsy. So you can then see if this is an appropriate technology for getting more information about the patient's cancer status, progression, and response to treatment. And so I love that because I actually have patients on the schedule, as I said, every 3 to 6 months, depending what their status is, how aggressive their disease is, how long I've been following them, how stable I think they are. And so you're getting always present tense information. And that's really important because historically we just had a biopsy from or tissue from a surgery, and then the patient had treatment. So the cells that we have in storage that we collected before treatment are now not the same cells that are traveling in the bloodstream and growing in the patient because they've responded to the hostile environment of the treatment, and or they have become more efficient at hiding from the immune system or disabling the immune system. So it's not really apples to apples when you look at old biopsy tissue. We want to get present tense information. So this type of a technology gives us the opportunity to do that. So again, just to reiterate, if you can't get a tissue from a biopsy, or you did a biopsy and there isn't enough tissue for all the analyses that everybody wants to do, if the cancer starts in a place that's difficult to access surgically, or if you have a metastatic lesion that is inaccessible, often the primary tumor and the metastatic satellites are actually different cells. And so you're wanting to be able to look at the cells that are the most resistant and the most aggressive, and you get an opportunity to do that with these liquid biopsies. What about if the cancer recurs after a surgery and you thought that the patient, was NED, no evidence of disease, and then you can monitor for recurrence more easily. Patients who are not responding to treatment can be found sooner without a scan, and the patient might just, have a preference not to have any more invasive biopsies. And then again, we're monitoring for progression. So just to reiterate all those good reasons. Now, the technology itself can look at single nucleotide polymorphisms, different changes of insertions and deletions into genes. So we're looking at mutations, basically, in the DNA, and also we can look for receptors on the cells and amplification of gene expression as well. And we can also find amplification of the proteins that those genes map for. And this is just going to expand, and this is actually much more recent to be able to use these cells in this way. And it makes it much, much more valuable. And I'm going to present you with a case study that demonstrates that. I have given you a slide, whether you're looking at them or not right now. I just want to tell you, I'm giving you a slide of the Biocept requisition so you get a sense of the kind of things that you can order. So I always check the box for the count of the circulating tumor cells. And then I'll look at what my options are for the type of cancer that my patient has. And so this lab has put together panels of biomarkers and genes and gene expression that you can look for, and receptors that you can look for a given cancer. And so that makes it easier. However, the list here doesn't, on the requisition, doesn't include pancreatic cancer, and pancreatic cancer is now approved for circulating tumor cell very recently. So they will update their form. But for example, if you wanted to see if there were HER2 new receptors on that tissue or estrogen receptors, which you can find both in lung and pancreatic tissues, you could check those boxes and just make your own little panel. I always, if a patient has a hormonal cancer, I'll always check all of the receptors for hormones. And also, I'll always check in breast cancer the HER2 new, because a patient can transform in one direction or the other, and that changes what you would do therapeutically. They might be HER2 negative at first and become HER2 positive, and then you have other treatment choices. I'm going to show you a case like that. And then also the molecular things that can be measured from these cells are things like epidermal growth factor receptor and the KRAS and BRAF genes, which are, for example, important in colorectal and melanoma cancers. So you can also look and see if P10 is expressed or not. And I'm going to talk about that as well. So you can actually now really use this in a much more complex and valuable way. All right. So let's just look at a few examples of why this could be valuable in tracking and making decisions. So for example, is an example of a case where the patient was HER2 negative originally, and upon analysis of circulating tumor cells, some of the cells were found to be HER2 positive. And so now the patient was a candidate for the targeted therapies for HER2 new positive patients. And so it opened up another window, but it also meant that there was a much more aggressive cancer going on. And because the HER2 oncogene turns on many pathways. It turns on the PI3K, AKT pathway, the MAPK pathway, and the STAT STAT pathway. And so these are aggressive, highly proliferative cancers. And so the ability to know that that had happened really could potentially save a patient from a lot of disease progression. Now, I think it's not well known that there's a lot of other tissues, tumor tissues that can express the HER2 new receptor. We're most familiar with breast cancer, pancreatic cells do, ovarian, gastric, esophageal, lung, uterine, and endometrial, and some testicular cancers. And I think I've seen some brain cancers with HER2 new positive. So it has a wide application. And now the change in approval for treatments is not based on the name of your cancer or where it's located, but whether you have receptors or gene expression. So you can actually get approval of these drugs that were typically historically only approved for breast cancer for these other cancers. So you can measure HER2 new in the serum also. It's just not that accurate. But if you find it, you can say it's there. It's just that you might miss it. So this is a more reliable way to ask and answer if there's HER2 new expression. And many, many oncologists don't order these more complex receptor and gene expression panels. And so I'll just educate the patient and say, you need to ask your doctor to order these things for you, or I'll order them. All right. So the other thing that's valuable in the era of immunotherapy is to find out whether cells have the expression of PD-L1 or PD-1. So PD-1 is a receptor, and it is expressed by T cells, and cancer cells can disable T cells by putting the brakes on the immune system and not letting them go after the tumor cells. And this is one of the characteristics, one of the hallmarks of cancer. So the immunotherapies leverage this fact, and if you can block that receptor, then the off switch remains on, and the immune system remains able to respond. The problem with this technology is if it's been turned off and then you turn it back on, you can get a forest fire, and all we really want is a coal, a burning ember. So that is why autoimmune disease is often the sequela of these immunotherapies, and hopefully it will all become more graceful and better controlled as we go forward. But there are many tumor types that we now know that we can test for expression of these genes and receptors. And if they are found, then the patient, again, is potentially a candidate for targeted therapies like Keytruda and Opdivo and Tecentriq. And so the first to be used widely was Opdivo in lung cancers, and it really changed the survival time of lung cancer patients. And now, because we understand more about receptors and and gene expression, there's a wider universe of cancers where this is being looked at, and that includes all kinds of cancers, melanomas, non-squamous and squamous cell lung cancers, breast, ovarian, pancreatic, esophageal, kidney, bladder, and even the hematopoietic cancers that are not solid tumors. So that's really amazing, because that is one of the challenges in cancer. If the cancer is good at disabling the immune system, then the best way to fight cancer is not available. So that is able to be looked at without biopsy tissue now because of these tumor cells. And another example, there's more examples, but another example is you can look at gene expression. So one of the things I like to be able to look at is the PTEN gene. Now, the PTEN gene is a tumor suppressor gene. And that gene is often turned off in many tumor cell lines, and which allows more growth and proliferation. The control, the brakes have been taken off of the genes that keep tumors, oncogenes from being expressed. And so we have in our toolbox a number of phytochemicals that are able to turn PTEN back on. So if you know it's off, then you know to add Hanokiol, H-O-N-O-K-I-O-L, to your treatment plan, and 1 or 2 grams a day, because it can help to signal to turn that gene back on. And so these are just 3 examples of changing receptors and immunotherapy, whether or not a patient's candidate for immunotherapy, and whether or not there's a loss of expression of tumor suppressor genes. So this is how I find this to be very valuable. There are a couple of slides in here that just are visuals of kind of the process. The cells are collected in special tubes, and then there's a filtering process that can gather the circulating tumor cells and the cell-free tumor DNA, and then they're put on little chips that have the ability to interact with these characteristics of the cell. And then when you get the report back, you actually get a picture of the cells they found as well. So, and the same with a cell-free tumor DNA, there's a filtering process, and then there are machines they put this into to analyze the expression of the DNA that's there. So it's pretty amazing to me. So that's what I really pretty much wanted to just give you the high altitude view, so that you could think about if you have patients that you want to track. Remember that patients who have become treatment resistant and the oncologist has chosen another treatment, you'd want to know pretty early on if it was going to work or not. Patients have very aggressive, hard to treat cancers. You'd want to know if the chemo cocktail was going to work or not. Like, think about pancreatic cancer patients tend to be chemo resistant. Think about patients who live a long time. You'd want to know if they're starting to have micrometastases. So that would be like breast cancer patients and prostate cancer patients. So I find this very useful. And I also have protocols for working with patients that we know are having micrometastases. So we'll do that in another lecture. So I'm going to take a break right now and let people ask questions. So you can press *7 if you have a question or you want to share your own use of this. I will pause. Nobody has a question. Okay. All right. So I'm going to go on to the questions that were submitted by other students and go over those. And these are all in the notes also. So Dr. Tolentino, who's here in LA, she had read an article which she sent to me, a published paper, that was a cell study that begs the question, does resveratrol fuel HER2-new breast cancer? So this is a question posed in the study, and a statement is also made in the study that because resveratrol itself, it's dosage, the administration of it, its bioavailability, quality of it, for example, is in this multifaceted interaction with unique molecular traits of different types of breast cancer. We know there are many subtypes of breast cancer, and I just stated that the HER2-new are particularly aggressive, so we shouldn't really use something that might fuel it or increase expression of that receptor. So the question again is, resveratrol protective, or does it fuel breast cancer? So the answer is we don't know, and we especially don't know when we only have cell studies. So I think this is a good question. So what I did is I did a PubMed search and looked to see if there was any other studies that was asking this question. Of course, they're all cell studies as well. But I found a study from 2013 that used liposomal encapsulation of curcumin and resveratrol and found in known overexpressing HER2-new cell lines, and found that there was more cytotoxic effect with Herceptin when you gave the resveratrol and the curcumin to HER2-new patients. You got a better outcome. So again, that was a cell study. And then I put in, and this is really my bigger answer to the question, I put in a bunch of studies that show how resveratrol does have a lot of value, and then I'll tell you what I think because of that. So I found some really good, very current articles, published papers on known effects of resveratrol, known physiologic effects. And so this is a really good paper to educate yourself about resveratrol. This one is called Cancer Chemo Prevention by Resveratrol, the P53 Tumor Suppressor Protein as a Promising Molecular Target. Now, remember, there is a lecture in the course on resveratrol where in the Materia Medica section of the course, where there is actually an infographic about resveratrol showing it has over 50 different known actions with receptor and gene expression. And so I think we need to remember that plant medicine, phytochemicals are multitaskers. And my question is, does the fact that resveratrol is such a multitasker outweigh the fact that it might promote the receptor? Are there other factors in a plant or in a plant chemical that mitigate that? Because that's kind of how plant medicine is safe, is that a lot of the adverse effects of plant medicine, because there's so many effects and plant chemicals bind to so many different receptors and have so many different functions, that we don't get a lot of adverse effects. But this is an important question, so I don't want to downplay that. I actually, for many years, have used as high a dose as 5 grams of resveratrol a day. And I have, in my small subset of patients, have not seen cancer accelerate in patients who are taking those doses. But this study does give one pause. And since HER2-new receptors are found on many cancers, we would not want to increase their expression. So the answer is we don't know. And I would say in cancers, if we can measure whether or not there's HER2-new receptors, then we have a better basis for saying whether or not we want to use resveratrol. But remember that it really changes a lot of the hallmarks of cancer. It is able to suppress proliferation and initiation, tumorigenesis, and it interacts with a lot of the cytochrome P450 enzymes. It changes redox status. It acts as a selective estrogen receptor modulator, like tamoxifen. It can bind loosely to estrogen receptors. It acts as an aromatase inhibitor. It acts as a growth inhibitor. It inhibits apoptosis, all these things. It's anti-angiogenic. So there's all these things we want, we value it for. So it's a dilemma. I would say the historical use of resveratrol, it's not correlated with increases in breast cancer, and particularly aggressive breast cancer. It's quite the contrary. It's often found in treatment plans where we're trying to control breast cancer and breast cancer recurrences. So That leaves you with nothing definite, but that is the nature of medicine anyway. I did find a 2018 paper called Regulation of Cell Signaling Pathways and MicroRNAs by Resveratrol in Different Cancers. And so this is looking at how different microRNAs signal differently, and this may lead us to, you know, more refined analyses and answers. But I thank you, Dr. Tolentino, for bringing this to our attention, because it's an important question, because HER2NU is aggressive, makes the tumors aggressive. So that's kind of an overview and things to think about, basically. We need to do more studies, and we need to be able to maybe even retrospectively look back at cancer patients who are known HER2NU patients and look at the trajectory of their disease and the rates of recurrence, et cetera. So I think these are worthy questions. I will pause there and see if anyone wants to chime in, has an opinion or experience or knowledge they would like to share. Nope. Okay. If you think of something, just unmute yourself and, you know, we can chat. All right, so there's three questions were submitted by Susie Thompson. One of the questions, and these are all about hypercoagulation risk and how to manage hypercoagulation risk and hypercoagulation in cancer patients. So one of her questions is this information within the course materials? There was a very good clinical PEARL lecture with very detailed slides in the June 14th, 2017 Grand Rounds call. And so the MP3 audio file and the slides are there. And so I've put a piece of that lecture's outline into these notes, and I'll go over it with you just so you have the big ideas in this call. But you can go to that, and you'll find a good discussion of it. Another question was, what about the interactions and safety guidelines for using turmeric and resveratrol and omega-3 fatty acids in patients who are on oral anticoagulants? And so we know that turmeric and resveratrol and omega-3 fatty acids are really inhibitors of platelet aggregation primarily. They're pretty mild also. And you know, if you do have a patient on, you know, 6 grams of curcumin and 5 grams of resveratrol and 4 grams of omega-3 fatty acids, doses that I tend to use, you can see bruising in some patients, but I actually don't see it very often. So again, because these botanicals and the omega-3s are short acting, they have very short half-lives, if you see that happening, you just stop giving it, and the impact is over in 6 to 12 hours. So no one will bleed out from high oral doses. But if a patient's going to have a surgical procedure where you'd want them to be able to clot faster, you could withhold them for 24 hours and be sure that there was no impact. Think about it like that. Even the new oral anticoagulants like Eliquis and Pradaxa, they are fairly short-acting also. So we withhold those for only 36 hours before a procedure, and then the patient can go right back on them because they're so short-acting. Remember, you have to understand that clotting is a complex series of steps, and so it depends what agent you're using, where the clotting gets interrupted. And so the most of the pharmaceuticals are able to inhibit fibrin, which there really aren't I don't really know of anything that inhibits fibrin formation in the plant world. The proteolytic enzymes can break it down, but I don't really know anything that's effective at inhibiting fibrin, and that's why the things we use are safe and don't lead to hemorrhage and excess bruising in the way that the drugs do, because they're interacting at different points in the clotting process. But I do have a slide that I've attached to this talk that I'll go over with you in a moment. And then the third question that was asked is, Could you provide guidelines for a patient who is currently on anticoagulant medication who would like to take nutraceuticals and phytochemicals as well? So when a question like this is asked, I can't answer it without a case study being presented because our approach is individualized. We have to know what the medication is, the cardiovascular history of the patient, the oncology history of the patient, are they obese, do they have diabetes, are they very inflamed, etc. There's just not enough information to ask from the way we put treatment plans together. So you have to, if you really want guidelines on a patient, you have to do the hard work of putting a real case study together so that you can learn how to practice in this way and how to think in this way. And so we would want to know all these comorbid factors. We'd want to know all the drugs the patient was on, all the other supplements they were on, and their history and their current signs and symptoms so that we could answer this question safely and effectively for a unique individual. So if you would like to have that, Susie, then put a whole case study together and I'll absolutely go through it and help you think through it and come to the conclusions that you can own the knowledge that way. And so that goes for everyone. It's just not that this isn't cookbook medicine, right? This is not cookbook medicine. This is highly individualized medicine. And so we need that individual information to be able to think what's best for each patient. All right, so I did put a summary of notes from that other lecture in the notes for this call. And so let's just review that a little bit so you have the big concepts and can think about it. So this is why it's so important, why I talk about it a lot, and why we should be able to assess our patients and intervene, because cancer patients overall have a sevenfold higher risk of a thrombosis. Hypercoagulation is a fact of the cancer terrain, the tumor microenvironment. It is happening in every patient to some degree. Patients with hematologic malignancies will have a 28-fold higher risk of a thrombosis. These are venous thromboses. And patients with metastatic disease have a 20-fold higher risk because as the disease is more advanced, as the disease spreads and is in more locations, the factors that signal hypercoagulation are also in greater volume and in time and volume. And so the reason that this really should be managed well is because 40% of cancer deaths are related to a thrombosis. So physicians know this, but tend not to treat because the drugs are so strong and a lot of patients have low platelets, which is part of the clotting pathway. And so if you anticoagulate somebody who's low platelets with a pharmaceutical, they can bleed out. So I think we have a role here if we monitor these patients and understand how to safely give them things that will take them farther away from having a big thrombus that is life-threatening form. I did have a patient in my office. She was an ovarian cancer patient. And it's interesting, certain cancers promote coagulation more. Breast, ovarian, and pancreatic cancer patients, I see much more high levels of coagulation in those patients. So I had a patient come in who had a port in her arm, and below that port was a chain of blood clots that I could see. And so I immediately called her physician because if one of those were to travel the other direction towards her heart and lungs, we would be in trouble. So I sent her immediately over to be anticoagulated with heparin to try and reduce the formation of new clots and dissolve those high-risk clots. But this was a patient that, you know, didn't see her oncologist frequently. Maybe every week, 2 weeks, or 3 weeks. And so how would the physician have known? And the patient didn't know that was that dangerous. And so thank goodness she was in my office and we could ask. So it's very, very common. And I think because we have more contact with patients, know them better, spend more time with them, we can do more patient teaching of things to look for and report to us. We can track their blood because the oncologist doesn't usually look at fibrinogen and D-dimer. And so we want to be watching these patients. And just remember, if your patient is sedentary and dehydrated, if they've had surgery, if they're undergoing chemo and radiation or hormonal therapies right now, if they're more inflamed, they have more tumor burden, they have more advanced disease, they have this risk in a much higher way. So cancer patients are very at risk. So we are looking at their blood, and so if you are just have a CBC to look at, if their red cells are low, their platelets are low, and their white blood cells are high, that is a prothrombotic profile. If you're measuring their D-dimer and fibrinogen, which I think is important to track, and then we can sometimes inform the oncologist that the patient is moving to a high-risk profile, then I think that's important for us to watch and be part of a team. If the CRP is high, and it can be when you have big tumor burden, then that is a prothrombotic environment. Patients who have homocysteinemia with homocysteines above 8 in general have a more prothrombotic environment, so it could be a factor in a lot of cancer patients. And I track transforming growth factor beta in a lot of my patients, which is an inflammatory cytokine that I track, and not all labs do it, but it's germane in some cancers, and it can be a biomarker that's reflective of progression or regression, like in the sarcomas. And we need as many handholds as we can get in some of the tougher cancers. So I'll watch that, but it varies. Transforming growth factor beta 1 can be a positive or a negative factor in the tumor microenvironment. And again, you need to know your patient. So what are some of the things that we can do about this? So again, the proteases are very powerful. They're used in functional medicine cardiology. So fibrin is a protein, and it can be broken down by lumbokinase and notokinase. Remember, these are short acting. For proteolytic enzymes to be able to do that, you take them on an empty stomach so they get into the bloodstream and work on what's floating around in the bloodstream instead of working on your food in your gut. And if you dose the enzymes a couple times a day on an empty stomach, you can put patients into a safer physiology. And then we know that a lot of the things we are using anyway are good at preventing the formation of smaller clots because they really interact with platelet aggregation. So all the curcuminoids, resveratrol, berberine, salvinolic acid from Chinese red sage, the salvia miltiarize, it's one of my favorite botanicals to use in high doses with patients who have active hypercoagulation. It also has a lot of other signaling benefits. It's one of my favorite herbs. I do talk about it a lot. The ginsenosides have mild inhibition of platelet aggregation, and polysaccharide-rich botanicals and mushrooms. Also, Angelica sinensis, which is Dong Quai, is also very good for people who are tipping into hypercoagulation. It's used in a lot of cardiovascular patients. And the astragalus that we frequently use to boost immunity is polysaccharide-rich and will reduce platelet aggregation. And then quercetin also does that. And sometimes we use that bioflavonoid in our protocols in higher doses. So a lot of things we use are already giving the patient protection. So we're already keeping them safer by just the toolbox of our Materia Medica. And also, then what I'll do is I'll add or increase the dose of the red sage, the salvinolic acids, tansinones, and cryptotansinones in that plant are really great for decreasing fibrin formation and also helping break up fibrosis, like in post-surgical patients, like have a lot of adhesions. So it's one of my favorite herbs, and it really keeps people safe. And it doesn't taste bitter, so patients will use it. And the extract of it is deep deep red wine red. I mean, it's just full of antioxidants. That color tells you that as well. So it's a good scavenger of free radicals. So a lot of plants have these qualities. The omega-3 fatty acids, anything that inhibits prostaglandins and thromboxanes will be able to do that. So Boswellia falls in that category as well. Be mindful of monitoring the patient, telling them how to report to you if they're bruising easily or if they're getting nosebleeds or if they're brushing their teeth and their gums are bleeding more than usual. Those are the signs that they're over anticoagulated by us. So then you had the question, Susie, about what if someone is taking a anticoagulant. Somebody's on heparin. I'm more conservative with the list of these herbs that I have for you here. But if they're on Pradaxa or if they are on Eliquis, the newer drugs, I find that they just act so differently that there isn't interaction. So I just watch the patient and see where they are in that continuum. And I'm also watching their blood, right? And but of course, if a patient's on Coumadin, which is not in use as much anymore, but in patients who have formed clots and have had embolisms, they are still put on Coumadin sometimes. And then you want to be very careful with interactions, be even more conservative with your dosing. The patient will be stabilized to a dose of Coumadin. So if their herbs and foods are also regular and constant, then you're okay. And so a lot of patients are told not to eat any green vegetables because of the vitamin K. So on Coumadin. So the Coumadin interacts with vitamin K. And so we don't want to give oral vitamin K in a supplement form. But I have found that the vitamin K in green plants is never ingested at a dose that actually creates drug interactions. I certainly might caution a patient from drinking green juice all day long, but I never want to take patients off vegetables, so I don't. I explain to the patient the importance of keeping their diet the same and keeping their supplements regular and the same while they're on Coumadin if they want to be able to use these things and eat a diet rich in vegetables. And so these patients on Coumadin are monitored very closely by their physician too. All right, so the goals then, we want to teach, oh, I didn't finish. There are the pharmaceuticals, I mentioned several of them, but remember aspirin falls in the antiplatelet aggregation, anti-inflammatory category. And there's studies on colorectal cancer from people who take aspirin that really reduces occurrence and recurrence and overall survival. There's some studies on breast cancer. Of course, aspirin can be toxic. So it can make your stomach bleed. So you have to be mindful. But if the physician has insisted on it, then teach the patient how to be safe with aspirin. And always take it with food in their stomach and report any odd bleeding, just like we would with any patient. We're concerned about their coagulation. We want to teach them how to eat an anti-inflammatory diet, which changes the cancer terrain to tip away from coagulation. And we want to make sure we teach the patient about lifestyle habits like hydration and movement, so that being sedentary is a great way to get a blood clot and being dehydrated is a great way to get a blood clot. So we can do a lot of patient teaching that doesn't happen in an oncology office for patients who have these risks. I have included a slide that shows kind of a cascade of events that leads to fibrin formation. And there's a element in the blood called tissue factor. And when this becomes activated in an inflammatory environment, then you also get triggering of angiogenesis. You get more VEGF, vascular endothelial growth factor. So you're getting more blood vessels and you're getting more fibrin that can help the tumor cell hide from the immune system. It all kind of comes in a symphony together. And the tumors are also shedding little platelet microparticles, and the microparticles are in the bloodstream as well, and they stick on to the tumor cells. And so you have this environment that's getting increasingly sticky, basically. And so then a few steps happen and you form thrombin, and from thrombin which binds to platelets, and then you get the formation of these really sticky fibrin proteins that are in a dimer. There's two stuck together, and they literally form like lace over the surface of a tumor cell. And so the platelets go there, and they're all sticky, and then the fibrin sticks there. And then the receptors, the binding receptors, are not available to any therapeutic interventions, or less available. And so the things that we give therapeutically that we need to have bind can't do so. But even more so, the immune system can't see or get to receptors or to the membrane in some cases. So this is very disabling to the ways that the body can fight cancer through the immune system, but also by therapeutic interventions, whether they are standard of care or our own. A patient who has hypercoagulation is less responsive to therapy. So reducing fibrin formation and breaking up these dimers is a good thing to do. So what you're measuring in D-dimer is the half of the fibrin protein that's showing you, high D-dimer, showing you this process is going on in the blood. And in regular conventional medicine, a high D-dimer is a patient at risk for a thrombus very soon. So a lot of patients don't order D-dimer because they don't want to be responsible for a patient having an embolism. And I know physicians, that's the reason they don't order D-dimer. All right, so let me pause there and allow you to ask questions. But number one, you have to understand the physiology. You have to be measuring biomarkers in your patient. You need to know the other drugs they're on, and you need to know their other comorbid factors to figure out what is safe to do and whether you should be calling their oncologist as well. So let me pause. And if anyone has questions about hypercoagulation or any other herbs or supplements or any other drugs, I'm happy to answer those. So I do not see anybody unmuting themselves. All right, so let me go on. There is one last question, which is also from Susie Thompson. And she asked, should girls be getting HPV vaccines? So I'm going to start by saying this is not my area of expertise, but I will render an opinion on it and show you some of the data that has been gathered over a period of 10 years while these vaccines have been in use. I think that there is a tendency in the natural medicine world to just be anti-vaccine, but there are some vaccines that are worth doing. A lot of the problems with vaccines is you're introducing foreign proteins into an immune system in order to get a reaction. And historically, there was also mercury as a preservative in a lot of vaccines. And so these are the reasons vaccines can be dangerous. And so you want to be careful who gets a vaccine. So if I had a girl who had a lot of autoimmune disease, I might not give her a vaccine because it might ramp up her autoimmune disease. She probably would have a bigger response to a vaccine than somebody who's immunosuppressed. So again, vaccines don't work very well if a person is immunosuppressed. So there is a practice in naturopathic medicine of giving something like astragalus, which ramps up immune response simultaneously to vaccines administration to make the vaccine have a better response, produce more antibodies. So you have to look. You don't give somebody a vaccine in the middle of an infection, you know, when they're compromised. And so you have to just look at the risk factors. And I'm careful which vaccines are given because there are problems with vaccines. But the data on this is pretty compelling. Over 10 years of looking at different varieties of the HPV vaccine, there was this paper that looked at 65 different studies that encompassed girls and women in high-income countries, so this first world, and includes 60 million individuals over a period of 8 years. And over that time, the rates of HPV infections, particularly the ones that tend to transform into cervical cancer, were reduced in the ballpark of 90%. I think that's pretty compelling. And so I think about smallpox, right, that pretty much eradicated because of vaccine use. So there are some girls that have bad inflammatory reactions to these vaccines, but those tend to be patients who have inflammatory reactions to lots of other things too. So I'm careful in those patients, typically autoimmune patients. I don't recommend a lot of vaccines, but you have to also look at the girl, because if she is really, really actively sexual at a young age, this study also showed that HPV viruses are endemic in the human population. If you tested someone's skin, you'll find them. If you test the intestines, you'll find them. If you test the cervix and the vagina, you'll find them. So we know that particular strains are more carcinogenic, more tumorigenic. And so we've identified some of those. We can test for some of those, and vaccines have been made against those. This study also states the natural, or there's another study here I put that tells the natural history of HPV viruses. And it states that most people exposed to even the more virulent HPV viruses will develop immunity within a period of 1 or 2 years. So, you know, you have to try and see the sexual behavior of the girl and if she's likely to have a problem. Another study showed that patients who are high in intake of alcohol, smokers, there's certain genetic risk factors, defective immune responses we mentioned, and autoimmune patients and patients with known HLA, more antigenic type responses to things, don't really respond well and will have more persistent infections also. So you might want to set it up to get a good response from a vaccine and have the girl, you know, go through a period of detox and be in a better position to have a good response from the vaccine. But when the data is like this, there is a conclusion that if we were able to vaccinate more people in the world, those that also don't have the socioeconomic privileges that we have, that we might also eradicate cervical cancer. Now, for most of us, we have access to medical care. We have good diets. We are privileged socioeconomically. Most of us have not experienced poverty or malnutrition unless we go ourselves on some weird diet. So we also will respond better to vaccines. And so we have to remember who the data is reflecting. But if it's possible to eradicate cervical cancer kills women. And it's, as you can imagine, a horrible experience to have it or be treated by it for it. In my milieu, my social milieu, when I was a young woman, there was no HPV vaccine. And so a lot of us got HPV infections, and we had to treat them, and we had to have cervical exams regularly, colposcopies, and we had to have procedures a lot of the time. And so now that's become much, much more rare. And I haven't seen a cervical cancer patient in my practice in, you know, over 15 years. So there has been more screening for it. There has been now the vaccine. So I don't even see patients with HPV in my practice much. But remember, HPV is also the cause of a handful of head and neck cancers from oral sex. And so there's a good reason to vaccinate as well. It's a few different strains of the viruses. But this is an instance where I think if we consider the individual patient, whether or not they're a good candidate to have a good response to a vaccine, whether or not they're really high risk, and whether or not they have immune competence, I think that's very important. And I still feel that, you know, a yearly pap smear looking for the HPV virus is really important. That's what, before the vaccines, That's what caused the decline in cervical cancers, and people have that kind of access to healthcare. So that's my thinking about it. I included a couple of these large cohort studies and reviews that show these statistics, talk about different kinds of patients' risk factors. And then also I put in a good paper that really talks about the natural history of HPV in humans, just to get that overview. And then I put some notes in what we actually do in naturopathic medicine that actually works, because we can treat HPV. And so there is a very well-known naturopathic gynecologist, Dr. Tori Hudson. She practices up in Oregon, and she has a lot of protocols that have been used for decades. So I put one of hers, which has 1,500 milligrams of Coriolis daily, twice daily. So that's 3 grams a day, falling in the ballpark of what we use. 5 milligrams of methyl tetrahydrofolate, methylated folate, that produces a turnover of the cervical cells. Selenium and diindol methane, or some kind of sulforaphane supplement. Those are the oral things. And then there's also a protocol of using vaginal suppositories, things that are antiviral, like vitamin A suppositories, and lomatium is an antiviral herb that's been used in naturopathic oncology as a vaginal suppository. That also green tea suppositories are active against the HPV virus. Remember, other things like zinc is in and vitamin A orally are important to increase antiviral resistance. So those are the things that I have always used should I have a woman, but it's just not in my practice anymore. There's also very famous kind of formula for a suppository that's been used for a wide range of vaginal infections, and it's called VagPak, VAG-PAK, as suppositories, and it has a lot of those ingredients in it, but it also has some tea tree oil and thuya oil and some hydrastis, some golden seal in it. And so this ends up being a broad spectrum kind of treatment for bacterial, fungal, and viral infections in the vagina. And then remember that the pH of the vagina is very important. So if there's mycoplasma in there, that increases risk of other infections. It changes the microbiome. And if there's not enough of the healthy bacteria, it will become, the pH will go up. It won't be acidic enough. So another strategy that's used in naturopathic medicine is to use boric acid suppositories to acidify the vagina, and alternate those with suppositories of a probiotic to actually introduce healthy bacteria to compete with the pathogens. And I've done all of those things for decades, and usually it works. You know, if it works, if the woman is compliant, like everything we do. So I'll stop there and let anyone ask questions about cervical cancer, HPV, and vaccines. But I'm kind of middle path on vaccines. I'm a pragmatist.
Hello. Hey.
Yes. Is that Stacy?
Hey, this is Stacy. How are you?
Good. What do you have to say?
So I do see cervical cancer, a lot of it, and head and neck cancer and anal cancer. So those are the, and also there's some esophageal cancers that are HPV related.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
So it's still out there, and I can tell you that cervical cancer is a horrible way to die.
Mm-hmm.
It is awful. And so we're still going to see it until this generation is
yes.
vaccinated and it sort of, peters out. But I mean, I am a strong proponent of HPV vaccine for both boys and girls, because boys they get the head and neck cancer and have to go through all the morbidity of
mm-hmm.
head and neck radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Awful.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's, if we can prevent that, it's huge. So just my little shout out.
Yeah.
I still see a lot of cervical cancer.
And what age group are you seeing it?
I see it in mostly young women still in their 30s and 40s, but
right.
I saw a woman today who has metastatic disease. I've been treating her for years, and she's 68.
Yeah,
so, you know, you do see it's older women, too.
I would say it is actually my generation. I'm in my 60s. That were never vaccinated, we all got HPV infections.
Yep.
They were common in my generation. So I wouldn't be surprised to see women of my generation having, you know, HPV harbored in their bodies. And then, you know, there's a resistance in different cultural groups to getting these vaccinations and getting them early because some parents think it gives permission to be sexually active when they don't want to encourage their kids to do that. So there's a lot of cultural barriers still, but I think there is a cancer that has the potential to be eradicated. But your point is well taken. It's going to take a long time to get there, and we need to be on top of this.
Yeah.
And it's hard to control teenagers. So if we vaccinate them, we have a better chance of lowering the transmission, the vector, right?
Yep, I agree.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else?
Hi, it's Kristen here. I just wanted to say, as a mother of a 17-year-old who has started to become sexually active, I found this incredibly useful because I haven't had her vaccinated yet, but I've really been on the fence about it because, you know, she's going to go off to college soon. It is a generation that is absolutely open about their sexuality. We've raised them that way. So it's a form of protection. What I'm hearing loud and clear is that obviously we have the ability to make sure that the immune system is intact and obviously do preparatory work, but it's a good form of security that we can at least give them.
Yeah.
Because when they go off to college, you know, let's be honest, how compliant are they going to be with a very rigorous, you know, more botanical protocol? I don't really see that happening. What, not when they're that young and in their early 20s.
Right. Right.
So thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an important question. Thank you, Susie, for bringing it up. And I'm sure that there are other opinions that some people are more anti-vaccine than I am. But I think this is a case where there's not a lot of downside and there's a huge upside. And that's the risk versus benefit question, which we should all be asking. And I know it's six, we're a little over time. So I just want to briefly mention that I went to a lecture by Dr. Sarah Gottfried last weekend or 2 weekends ago. She's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant gynecologist and functional medicine doctor. And she talked about the value of using validated scales and validated questionnaires in our practices to assess patients. And a very, very old one that she feels has high value is the perceived stress scale. And it's a very short little questionnaire that patients fill out. And what it tells you is, does the patient perceive their current situation as exceeding their own ability to cope? So are they overwhelmed? And the studies on cancer patients with data from patients who fill these out also show that the patients who are more overwhelmed and feel that their perceived stress is really high, they tend to have worse outcomes, they tend to have worse quality of life, they tend to be less compliant patients. And so, and it is the magnitude of the initial stress that predicts what happens later, because people adapt and stress will go down. But if we understand what happens to patients early on in their process, we have a lot of tools to help them as well. And so I always, in my interview and my intake with patients, try to get a sense of this by talking with them. And I actually have a questionnaire, a question on my intake form, my new patient form, that says, rate your ability to cope with stress, and to ask if they tend to tip into more depression and melancholy or more anxiety. I ask them if they're a worrier, and I try to just see what kind of anxiety flavor they are as well. And I also try to find out if they have a good support system or not. Patients isolated and anxious and overwhelmed, they're just not going to do as well. And so I try to help them put together a support system, and and learn how to soothe themselves and have more agency. So I think this is huge for us because we get to know our patients better. But the emphasis on this paper here is that finding that out early leads to long-term benefits if we help patients cope and feel that their perceived stress is less. And my goal in a new patient encounter is to have the patient walk out the door less anxious than they walked in. And so I think it's important that we give patients this sense that they can have more control over what's happening to them with the kind of education and tools that we give them. And so I think that depending on how you practice, how you like to practice, if you want to have patients fill this out as becoming part of becoming a new patient, it also tells the patient something about you and what you're concerned about. So I just want to present that because Dr. Godfrey talked about it, and I hadn't thought about it in a long time, and I think it definitely fits in our patient population and what they're going through and their levels of stress. Dr. Donald Abrams asks patients, what gives you hope? What gives you strength? What gives you peace? He asks that in the first visit. So we have different ways to learn about our patients, and I think it's important to, you know, address that. And sometimes that's a bigger part of the first visit, is helping them feel they can cope and then get to the clinical stuff in the second visit. So I just wanted to bring that resource to all of you. I will stop and open this up to anyone else who would like to ask any more questions or make any comments or contribute their wisdom and knowledge. All right, everyone. Thanks for being here. Thanks for staying a little extra time. Everybody stayed. And I'll see you next month.